Hello, I'm Bob Welch. This is number 0603, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0603. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, adventure writer Marty Essen is back with his latest book called Hits, Heathens, and Hippos. Where does the title of the book come from?
Hits comes from two different things. First of all, I was a talent agent, and I managed rock and roll bands. And Hits also stands for a baseball league. I ran this baseball league for a couple years called the Bitterroot Baseball League. Heathens is I started growing up in a Christian family with an over-the-top Christian father who really, really pushed me on that. And I went the opposite direction and became a heathen. And hippos kind of comes from I'm one of the few people that has ever survived a hippo attack.
Melissa Yee is an emergency physician who also writes medical thrillers. Her latest is Scorpion Scheme. Which came first, wanting to be a doctor or wanting to be a writer?
Writing came first. You know, when I was in kindergarten, I knew that I wanted to be a writer, but I also knew that I wasn't guaranteed a roof over my head. So I just decided I like people, I'm good at school, I'm going to go for medicine. And I always wanted to be able to support myself. So that's what I did. And emergency medicine is great because you do shift work and then your time off is your time off and then you can write.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter mines some laughs with veteran comic John Byner and his memoir, 5 Minutes, Mr. Byner. So get ready for a bizarre Byner segment later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0603, was Bob Welch, who is an agent for New York Life Insurance Company serving New York, New Jersey, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Vermont. In other words, he gets around. Thank you very much, Bob, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Let me share with you what has got to be the laziest bank robber in history. A South Carolina man was arrested after handing a teller a note demanding money through a pneumatic tube at the bank drive-thru. So, right about now, you're saying to yourself, okay, he's too lazy to get out of his own car. No, not quite. Hartsville police said Angel Luis Mazdev went to the drive-thru at South State Bank in a taxi and placed a note in the tube demanding money or else he would kill people and blow the bank up within 2 minutes. Police arrived to find Mazdev in the passenger seat of a blue minivan parked in the middle lane. The taxi driver was also in the vehicle. Officers approached with weapons drawn and took Mazdev into custody. Investigators said Mazdev also had the taxi driver stop at a dollar store so he could buy envelopes before they went into the bank. Or at least to the bank, because they never really went inside. Mazdev was arrested and charged with entering a bank with the intent to steal. Again, he never really went into the bank, but I digress. He was also charged with attempted bank robbery and wearing masks. Like I said, really lazy. I'm surprised he wasn't carried to the drive-thru on one of those chairs that Egyptian pharaohs were carried around on. Lazy. Just lazy. Diplomats and their families from the Russian embassy in Pyongyang, North Korea, worked around extreme COVID-induced travel restrictions by pushing themselves across the border in a rail trolley to reach their home country on February 25th. The group of eight, including children, traveled 32 hours by train and 2 hours by bus to reach the Russian border, but trains and wagons cannot enter or leave North Korea, so the embassy's third secretary, Vladislav Sorokin, completed the last half mile of the journey by pushing the trolley filled with the group and their luggage on train tracks over the Tumen River, where they were then met by Russian officials at the border station. Okay, the kids can sit and enjoy the ride, but there wasn't another adult besides Vladislav who could jump out and help push? That's a lazy bunch. Next, they'll want to rob a bank using a cab. And finally, in the section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Sharon Carr of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was arrested by officers responding to a residential burglary call on February 26th when she stepped from the shadows in front of the victim's house. Investigators found a window screen removed and a window opened, where they allege that Carr entered the home but quickly left, leaving behind an empty Cheetos bag and a water bottle. Cheetos residue on Carr's teeth linked her to the crime, along with testimony from the victim. Carr was charged with first-degree burglary. Tulsa police said in a Facebook post, "A good reminder that Cheeto dust can be pretty hard to get rid of." Oh, I concur. Cheeto dust is like the herpes of food residue, just like glitter is the herpes of the craft world.
Take a Cheetos break with Cheetos.
Yeah, Sharon will get a break for a couple of years, and probably a break from Cheetos, too. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Marty Essen is back on the program. We had him on the show 5 years ago when his book Endangered Edens came out. Well, he's back on the show with his latest book. This one is called Hits, Heathens, and Hippos, Stories from an Agent, Activist, and Adventurer. He joins us on the line right now from Montana. Hi, Marty.
Hey, great to speak with you again, Peter.
Nice to have you back on the program with us. Pleasure to have you on. So, first off the bat, I got to ask, explain the title, Hits, Heathens, and Hippos.
Well, you know, what the book is about is, you know, I've had a lot of things that have happened during my life, and you know, I always try to look at things from a humorous point of view, so this is a humorous memoir, and Hits comes from two different things. First of all, when I used to live in Minnesota, I was a talent agent, and I managed rock and roll bands and contemporary jazz acts. And had a couple hits with those acts, including Andre Simone, who had a number three hit written by Prince called The Dance Electric. And Hits also stands for a baseball league. I ran out in out where I live now in Montana. I ran this baseball league for a couple years called the Bitterroot Baseball League, which was an adult baseball league where I had all these different prospects. But the players were out of control. And so that's where Hits comes from. Heathens is, well, this kind of book is kind of on how I started growing up in a Christian family with an over-the-top Christian father who really, really pushed me on that. And I went the opposite direction and became a heathen. So that's where that came from. And Hippos kind of comes from one of my most famous adventures, which I actually talk about in my first book, and I kind of recap again here in my new sixth book, is I'm one of the few people that has ever survived a hippo attack. When I was in Zimbabwe, heading down the Zambezi River, a hippo came underneath my canoe, bit through dead center of the canoe, lifted me 6 feet in the air, and then threw me on the ground. So that's where Hits, Heathens, and Hippos come from.
Wow. Now, I remember the last time we chatted, we talked about your various adventures in the past and the fact that you are literally a world traveler. You've seen all of it. For someone who travels as much as you, how has this last year been where people weren't allowed to leave their houses?
Well, you know, and that's kind of where I am, not leaving my house. You know, I'm lucky in that I live in Montana, and I moved out to Montana from Minneapolis, oh, probably close to about 20 years ago. And I moved out here primarily for the wildlife. I live kind of, I'm talking to you right now, in fact, basically on the side of a mountain I'm looking out through my big window of my writing room, and I'm looking at snow-capped mountains, trees all around, not a soul anywhere near me, but I'll have moose and elk, wolves and bear coming through my property all the time. So I kind of live in paradise right here. So I don't necessarily have to travel a lot right now. But yeah, I do kind of miss it. I do a lot of traveling, speaking at colleges all across the United States. Now, of course, I'm not doing that, so I'm doing everything via Zoom. And that's actually working out kind of good. So I've actually been busier during the COVID-19 pandemic than, you know, sometimes when I couldn't travel. And it's just, you know, technology has changed, and I've kind of changed with technology and to capitalize on that.
You mentioned your office, your writing room, has a panoramic view of the mountains and all that Montana has to offer. I'm guessing that could be somewhat of an inspiration for you as you write. But has it ever been a situation where it's a hindrance, where you're just kind of gazing out at that beauty and, you know, you kind of forget to write?
Oh, I don't know that happens. I think it's more of an inspiration. Because I don't have a lot of distractions other than that view. And actually, I kind of have two different views. In the winter, I have my office where I'm looking out over the mountains. And then in the summer, I move my entire office outside onto my front porch, where I've got a whole different view and a whole different type of animal coming by. And it's more of an inspiration than anything. I don't think it's ever been a hindrance.
You talk about, as you say, this is kind of a memoir, so I'm assuming you also go back to your days of when you were a DJ.
Yeah,
and I bring that up because you talked a little bit, you alluded to the fact that your father was very religious.
Yes,
having a son as a DJ, this is like right out of Footloose.
Yeah, you know, you hit it right. You know, at that point though, my father and my mother had divorced, and my father was living safely down in Florida. And so I was in Duluth, Minnesota at that time. And, you know, one of the themes in this book, and it's something, you know, that I really believe in, is people come across forks in the road, and you never know where that fork is going to take you. And those forks in the road can change your entire life. And I think one of my first forks in my road that changed my entire life is I was 13 years old, and I heard about a DJ from WEBC in Duluth who was coming to talk at a different class. And so I cut my class, and I went to listen to him. And that going to listen to him changed my entire life, because I went to listen to him, and he said that we needed volunteers over at the radio station to answer request lines. And so at 13 years old, like, they couldn't pay me because I was too young, but I worked for albums and concert tickets, answering request lines. And then how I know I was the youngest DJ in Minnesota history is back then you had to get a third-class broadcaster's license. And I don't think you have to get that anymore to be on the air, but it was a difficult test to take with some fairly difficult math in it. And I took my test the first time. I didn't pass it, but I was close enough that I was able to take it again right away. And then I passed it. I went on the air pretty much on my 16th birthday, which was as young as you could be, at least in Minnesota, with the child labor laws. So I was one of the first DJs ever to be on the air at that young in Minnesota. And then that kind of led into my career of being a talent agent, because I was, you know, in the music business and became a talent agent from there. And so that was just one of those forks in the road that that if I hadn't been in that classroom at that particular time, you know, who knows where my life would have gone.
Well, you mentioned all the forks in the road. You were a DJ. You owned a baseball,
yeah.
A baseball league. You've written all these nature books. You've traveled the world. What was the dream and goal initially of little Marty Essen when you were a kid? And did you achieve that, or was everything a fork in the road that took you a different direction?
Well, I think when I was a kid, my dream was to be a herpetologist, which is a type of zoologist that specializes in herpetofauna, which would be reptiles and amphibians. And, you know, in some ways, I never officially became a herpetologist, but my books are, you know, a lot of my books, at least, are my nonfiction books, are wildlife-oriented. My first book, Cool Creatures, Hot Planet, Exploring the Seven Continents, was all about wildlife, and one of my favorite adventures was, for instance, going down to the Amazon rainforest, where the place is crawling with reptiles and amphibians. And so I kind of met that goal in a little bit different way. It wasn't directly.
And yet you were almost done in by a hippo.
That was in Africa. But again, there was, you know, reptiles, amphibians as well. I was able to catch a giant snake while I was in Africa. That was kind of fun. Wildlife has always been a part of my life. And it certainly is in my books.
Now, I know you do a lot of traveling and you do a lot of adventure writing and travel books, and you travel with your wife.
Yes.
Have you ever decided or ever thought of doing a he said, a she said, or he saw, she saw book? In other words, I'd be kind of interested to read one of your books and then read the other side of the story from her eyes, the same adventure.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, no, I haven't done that. I think a lot of times we see things the same. But, you know, in every book that I write before it gets published, you know, it goes, of course, through editors and all that sort of thing as well. But my wife always reads all of the books ahead of time. And, you know, she has kind of been my guide on some of these things to make sure, you know, because, yeah, you're absolutely right. People will see things in a different way. And especially when I traveled to all seven continents, she kept this amazing journal of everything that happened. And I kind of tucked everything away in my brain. So we'd get back from an adventure, and I would have the way I believed it happened, and she would have what she had in her journals. And I'd go through her journals, and we kind of, you know, put the two together and make sure we got an accurate story.
Do you get a chance to live in the moment when you're traveling the world as you have done in the past? Or is it a situation of you're always looking at life through the lens of how it might be on the page when you finally write it?
Oh, that's an excellent, excellent question. You know, I think it's both. There was one definite time I can say it was, I thought about it for the book, and that was during my first book, Cool Creatures, Hot Planet, Exploring the Seven Continents. The last chapter in the book and the last trip was to Zimbabwe, Africa. And, you know, one of the things about writing a book where it's adventure travel is you always worry, well, is this trip going to be exciting? Is it going to be worth putting in a book? And I've been fortunate that literally every single one has been. But the very last chapter, the very last adventure, is with my wife and I getting attacked by the hippo in Zimbabwe and living through that. And so it was like, that got done. It was like, wow, what a great way to end a book. So, yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, you see it both ways.
Well, the book is called Hits, Heathens, and Hippos. And Marty, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being on the show with us once again.
Well, great. It's great to talk to you. And I'm so eager to get back into Canada, by the way. I'm hoping you guys are going to let us Americans into Canada sometime this fall. One of my favorite adventures was traveling all the way north to Nunavik, the very top of Canada. And we want to go do that again. So I'm hoping I can get back into your country sometime soon. But yeah, hey, thanks so much for having me on your show again. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Marty Essen, author of Hits, Heathens, and Hippos, Stories from an Agent, Activist, and Adventurer. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this program, which is show number 0603, and you'll find links to Marty's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You'll also find the link into our archives to show number 0333 to hear the previous appearance that Marty had on the show. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. On the air, on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Scorpion Scheme, plus we'll have another edition of Book Banter. Stuart Nullman will be along once again. We also have an Idiot of the Day and much more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And belated welcome to the fine folks who listen to us on The Podcast Station. Check out The Podcast Station. You'll find it on Facebook at facebook.com/ThePodcastStation. And welcome aboard. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Federal investigators allege that Richard Machete of Ridley Park, Pennsylvania, was among the rioters at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. He was linked to the insurrection through a series of text messages and videos he sent to his ex-girlfriend. "Gotta stop the vote. It's fraud. This is our country," one of the messages said. When the unnamed woman apparently expressed doubt that the election was rigged, he texted, "If you can't see the election was stolen, you're a moron." The ex took the messages to law enforcement the next day and helped identify him in other videos and pictures the FBI had. Machete was arrested on multiple charges and released with electronic monitoring until his hearing. Hell hath no fury, like an ex you send evidence of a major crime to, and then call a moron. Yeah. Well, let me share an important tip with you. If you are going to Google how to set your car on fire and make it look like an accident before reporting your car stolen, use a library computer in a faraway town in incognito mode, not your own phone. A Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania man is facing charges after he allegedly set his own car on fire and reported it stolen. State police responded to the incident after 54-year-old Donald Cassidy reported his 2010 GMC Acadia stolen on February 15th. Upon investigation, troopers located the vehicle in the woods. The vehicle was set on fire and was unrecognizable. However, a visible VIN number on the vehicle verified Cassidy as the owner. Cassidy's phone was later obtained by troopers as evidence. A search of the phone's internet history revealed that Cassidy had reportedly searched for how to set your car on fire and make it look like an accident. Cassidy was subsequently charged with arson, false reports, and risking a catastrophe. How many crimes are solved these days just by checking someone's search history? I mean, while Cassidy doesn't quite rise to the level of idiot of the day, he is...
stupid! You're so stupid!
Yeah. You know, I was a very industrious capitalistic child. I had a paper route when I was 12. I used to sell chocolates door to door. I also used to buy bulk penny candy and sell them for 2 cents each at school. I did pretty well. But never did I think of selling tasers. One reason was they weren't around when I was a kid. And two, if they were, it would still be a weapon. A 12-year-old Tampa student is facing charges after she sold stun guns at Coleman Middle School. And yes, I said stun guns, plural. According to the Tampa Police Department, a staff member at the school alerted the administration that the student had brought the stun guns to campus. A school resource officer removed the student from class, and she admitted to purchasing 5 electronic stun guns online and brought them to school to sell to other students, later adding that she had already sold three of them on February 25th. The girl was found to be in possession of two black Viper-Tech stun guns. Police say there was no threat made to any individual or the school itself. She was taken to the Juvenile Assessment Center, charged with possession of a weapon on school property. And Tampa police say three sold stun guns have still not been located at this time. Well, somewhere out there are three parents who are going to get a shocking surprise. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File program, it's time once again for the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
In late February, 45-year-old Thangula Satish was killed in Telangana State in southern India when the rooster he was preparing for an illegal cockfight panicked and slashed him with the 3-inch blade strapped to its leg. Police Inspector B. Javan said Satish was hit by the rooster's knife in his groin and started bleeding heavily. He died on the way to hospital. Anyone feel sorry for this guy? Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Yeah. The rooster was removed to a poultry farm nearby. Stabbed in the groin by a rooster. You know, there is a more direct street way to state this incident by replacing groin and rooster with two other words that are synonymous with each other, but I digress. All I have to say is, the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Melissa Yee is an emergency physician and an award-winning writer. Her newest crime novel is called Scorpion Scheme, which takes her protagonist to Cairo, where she discovers a man with a nail through his skull who might hold the key to millions in buried gold. Melissa joins us via Skype from Ontario. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, this is something that is, it's not your first novel, and you're not the first person I've talked to in emergency medicine who is an award-winning writer. How did this start for you? Was writing something you always did and you gravitated toward medicine, or vice versa?
Writing came first. You know, when I was in kindergarten, I knew that I wanted to be a writer. But I also knew that I wasn't guaranteed a roof over my head. So I just decided, I like people, I'm good at school, I'm going to go for medicine. And I always wanted to be able to support myself. So that's what I did. And emergency medicine is great because you do shift work and then your time off is your time off and then you can write.
Now, when you say this was something you decided to do because it was more, shall we say, stable, is that you talking or is that your parents talking?
Well, I have ethnic parents, so for sure that was how I was raised. But they didn't browbeat me with it or anything like that. It was just something that I saw. I was like, I don't want to starve to death. I need something stable. Let me do medicine or something else that I enjoy that I know will make me some money.
They often say when you're writing to write something you know, you are writing about someone who is involved in medicine. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so she's a resident doctor, as was I when I started writing this. She wants to be an emergency doctor, so she's going to do 2 years of family medicine and then 1 year of emergency medicine. But every rotation, she meets a killer. And I think it was Montreal that partly inspired it because it was a bit of a shock for me coming from Ontario when I just saw the patients waiting on stretchers in the hallway and the lack of funding. And I was like, this could really drive someone to kill at the back of my head. So then I started writing a series where the resident physician solves crimes in her spare time.
And I guess it's also very important to note that, again, write what you know. Your protagonist, your lead character, is also Asian.
Yeah. I do write different races and cultures, but I felt that it was really important to have an Asian voice in fiction. I read a survey of movies, and they found that, you know, all races were underrepresented, but Asians was one of the worst. It was actually the same year that Avatar came out, and they calculated that the rate of people with blue skin was the same rate as your chances of seeing an Asian on film. It was just terrible. So I was like, well, I need to represent my people more. That was part of the inspiration.
The reason why I bring it up is because I'm just wondering when, you know, which is, it makes perfect sense to do it this way. But was there any pushback initially when you first started writing this character?
Well, one of the things that I hadn't fully thought through was that a lot of people were going to have trouble saying her last name, which is C. Her name is Hope C. But people are just like, how do you pronounce her name? And in every book, she'll say, just say like the letter C, or just think of it like seaweed, you know, or a tsetse fly. Like, she'll give people clues, but they'll still have trouble saying it. And I'll get reviews saying, I've read all her books, but I don't know how to say her name.
And we should
and
mention
that's pretty typical.
We should mention that C is spelled S-Z-E for those who are
correct.
Listening to this. That's why some people might have the problem with it. So how did this character come about for you? And you've written more than one. So what are you learning about Dr. Hope that you didn't know when you first started writing her?
Well, she is based a lot on me. So she's blunt. She works hard. She doesn't pull her punches. And she will fight to the death if someone tries to take her or any of her people down. So what have I learned? I guess the thing that is different for her is that and a lot of people comment on is that she does have a love triangle. She usually has at least two guys on the go, which is pretty unusual. And for me, I'm with my high school sweetheart. So that's something I had to invent. And that's been interesting, just trying to juggle the different relationships.
How does your high
school? For example, one of her guys is another physician.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't thought about it before, but they compete on the medical ward, but they're still together. So that's something I didn't have to do because my guy's an engineer, so we were never in the same field, really, after high school.
How does your high school sweetheart feel about your alter ego in the books?
He doesn't mind. He prefers fantasy and science fiction, which I also write. But it doesn't bother him to think of, you know, being in a love triangle or anything like that. Or at least he's never said anything to me.
So tell us about the plot line of Scorpion's Scheme. I mentioned a little bit about it in the introduction, but tell us a little bit about where this story goes.
Sure. Well, it's the eighth book. And one of the things that I have done was I had signed a contract with a travel company to travel to five different countries in exchange for writing novels set in those countries. And one part of the deal is that I am allowed to write my own books set in those countries that aren't related. So in this case, I knew that I had gone to Ecuador and I had gone to Egypt, and I knew that I wanted to write a book on Egypt. So part of the book is based on reality. Like, she lands, it's all a mess. For example, she goes to the bathroom and the toilet doesn't flush properly. So she pushes another button and gets sprayed neck to foot with water, which did happen to me. But in this case, the other thing that was based on real life was that my tour group was around a bomb. They weren't directly involved with it, but they were close enough to hear it and feel the ground shake and say, what was that? The tour guide said, oh, nothing, and hurried them away. I wasn't with the tour group because my son was having his birthday, so I had a later flight. But, you know, I was close enough to a bomb that could have hurt us. Like, it did hurt some South African tourists. None of them were killed, fortunately. But that was the basis for this book. So she goes out, and she's on the bus, and then there's a bomb in front of them that affects the bus in front of them.
Generally speaking, when you are traveling to various locales, and you're doing it as basically a source of information for a novel you might be writing, how does that change the travel experience for you?
Oh, I always love to take notes and pay attention. I guess I probably don't relax as much, and I'm sure I don't drink as much as everybody else who goes on trips. But for me, it just adds another layer. The only problem was, you know, working as a physician as well as writing, I didn't have time to research Egypt before I went. So that was the only bummer, was that it was later that I was sitting down and I was reading about ancient Egypt and stuff, and I didn't understand it fully at the time. So when I went to visit Hatshepsut's tomb, for example, like her mortuary temple, I was like, the guide was giving us information, and afterwards I stopped in and I was like, wait, I know this woman. I read about her in a cartoon. There was a cartoon book that I borrowed from my daughter on historical women leaders, and she was the pharaoh that they had talked about. And only because I had read this book did I have any idea who this woman was. And then it was only later that I unlocked her story about how she was one of the first major rulers and that she ruled for, I think it was 20 years. And to do so, she told everyone to call her a man because only men were allowed to rule at that time. Mm.
When, as someone who was the author of mystery novels and suspense novels, are you someone who plots out an entire story from beginning to end before you start writing? Or do you learn things about the plot as you are writing it?
Learn things as I go. So in writing, that's called pantsing versus plotting. And I'm very much a pantser, which is really too bad because it's much more efficient if you plot it out ahead of time and you know where you're going. You know, I throw away hundreds of thousands of words because afterwards I'm like, no, that wasn't good enough. Like, I really like to surprise myself as well as the reader.
And you also write medical humor too, right?
Yes, yes.
Now, isn't medical humor quite often for what we like to call either black or gallows humor?
Yeah, and actually people have commented on that for my Hope series as well, that I can be dark or some people say snarky. So it's not for everybody. And I don't think that, like, you don't necessarily have to write it that way. You know, I think that I'm pretty affectionate when I write in my medical writing regardless.
And the dog...
I don't know if you can hear my dog.
And the dog agrees. By the way, when it comes to dark and snarky, you've got me. That's...
Yeah, exactly. If I hit the right kind of people who understand it and who aren't shocked or appalled, that's usually a good mix.
Is it more... I mean, you've been doing this for a little while, but we've now reached a point in history where, you know, quite frankly, there's cancel culture and everybody's on walking on eggshells. Is it harder to write that kind of stuff when it seems to be that everyone seems to be triggered these days?
Yes, probably. in general, for medicine, I am surprised. Like, you do, for example, if you write for the CMAJ, I think it is, you have to get a waiver from anybody who might have inspired you. And I thought, well, that's a little odd. You know, like, I wouldn't run up to somebody I saw in the emergency room and say, oh, but I want to write about you. Could you sign this waiver? Like, and the other exceptions are if it's, quote, historical, unquote. So if it's been over 10 years since this has happened and that sort of thing, like, you do have to be really careful. Most people recommend that you write about an amalgamation of patients rather than one single patient. It's also considered okay if the not okay, but like, you don't have to get a waiver if the patient is deceased. So there's a lot of minefields for sure, and a lot of things to think about. I like to try to be sensitive to readers and to people in general, because you don't want to force people to see things or read things that they don't want to see or read. On the other hand, yeah, it is harder for creators.
So since you do a lot of medical writing and you also do mysteries and novels, what gives you the better joy, the serious medical writing, even though it's somewhat tinged with a little bit of humor, or your own creative writing?
I think my creative writing. I do enjoy the straight-up nonfiction because it allows me to connect with my colleagues through the medical post and that sort of thing. And it's really great just to be able to speak out, for example, on political issues or trying to advocate for PPE during COVID and that sort of thing. Like, it's an important work. But, of course, I love just inventing my own crap, you know, like, that's just the best.
Well, the current novel is called Scorpion Scheme, and Melissa, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Continued success with all you do.
Thank you, and the same to you, Peter.
Melissa Yee, author of Scorpion Scheme, which is the 8th book so far in the thriller series. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0603, and you'll find links to Melissa's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And to bring us a laugh or two, here he is once again, Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Well, I always bring you a laugh or two. Sometimes unintentional, you know?
Yes, that is true. But we also have a long history, both of us, working for Just for Laughs.
Yeah.
So there's a long history between the two of us and that organization.
Oh, yes. It goes back about a good,
30 years, yeah.
Whoa. That's a lot of comedians. Yeah, but on this edition of Book Banter, Peter, I want to ask you one question to start off with. Back in the 70s.
Yes.
You watch your share of TV shows.
Oh, absolutely. When did I stop? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But did you ever watch summer replacement shows?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Because, you know, I did too. I watched my share of those. And to me, they were like a TV vacation. Because summer replacement shows were mainly variety shows of a lighthearted nature that were hosted by entertainers who were well-known but had a medium degree of success appearing on TV variety specials, guest shots on primetime programs, late-night talk show circuit, they did nightclubs, or they were recording artists. And the list of those summer replacement hosts was quite impressive and eclectic at times. There was like Glenn Campbell, Jerry Reed, Clifton Davis, and Melba Moore, Manhattan Transfer, Ken Berry, Bobby Darin, Marilyn McCoo, and Billy Davis Jr., and the Jacksons. But it was one summer replacement show that really stuck with me. Back in the summer of 1972, CBS aired a comedy variety show hosted by a comedian named John Byner. And it was called the John Byner Comedy Hour. And it wasn't a flashy, dazzling type of summer replacement variety show. It consisted mostly of comedy sketches featuring Byner and his cast of regulars, in which he did a whole variety of original characters. And also I enjoyed when they segued from one sketch to another sketch, showing the cast moving around the scenery in a fast-motion photography, with accompanying music that was just as fast and frenetic. But overall, the show was funny because of how Byner's chameleon nature carried each sketch. Now, since the summer of 72, Byner appeared on a number of TV specials and talk shows. He was a favorite of the late Ed Sullivan and appeared on his top-rated variety show 17 times since 1964. He entertained audiences with his quick wit and dead-on impersonations of such celebrities as Ed Sullivan himself, Dean Martin, Bing Crosby, and John Wayne. As well, he provided the voices for a number of cartoon characters, including the Ant and the Aardvark, and it was Byner, not Jackie Mason, who did the voice of the Aardvark. He had a semi-regular role on the controversial ABC sitcom Soap. He hosted an edgy comedy sketch show on CTV called Bizarre. He appeared in movies with Henry Fonda, Burt Reynolds, and Jeff Goldblum, and even had a role in a Broadway play, the 2004 production of a musical version of Aristophanes' ancient play The Frogs, which he co-starred with Nathan Lane. Now, indeed, John Byner had a steady show business career for about 50 years, in which he happily provided and got plenty of laughs that lasted a lifetime. And it's that lifetime of laughter he fondly chronicles in his entertainment memoir called 5 Minutes, Mr. Byner. He's not a binder. he's a Long Island native, and after a stint in the Navy in the 50s, Byner started performing at clubs in the northeastern U.S. But it was in 1964 when he got his two biggest breaks, first touring the country as part of an impressive bill that included Harry James, Buddy Rich, and Nina Simone, and his first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. Now, that portion of the book, begins Biner's string of behind-the-scenes anecdotes that makes the book so enjoyable to read. And that's especially so when it comes to The Sullivan Show and the incredible luck he had when he landed that first on appearance. It was on March 1st of 64 that Biner got the chance to audition his act at CBS Studio 50, which was later called the Ed Sullivan Theater, where the show was produced during the dress rehearsal segment. And as he was ready to go home after the audition, Jack Babb, who was the show's talent coordinator, appeared in his dressing room and told him that Sullivan, a.k.a. the old man, liked his act so much that he wanted Biner to appear on the show. But on that night's show, which was about to go on the air live in just 2 hours' time.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep. Needless to say, Biner killed, and that really, his career took off from there. And as well, Biner recounts the good fortune he had meeting up with many well-known celebrities throughout his career. My favorite story dealt with his meeting with Rod Steiger, who was one of the actors he did a dead-on impression of. And at a cocktail party, in L.A., Biner finally had that opportunity to meet with Steiger. Now, when a mutual friend introduced each other and said Biner did an impersonation of him, Steiger asked if he impersonated him as the lead role in The Pawnbroker, one of his best-known movies. And when Biner admitted that he didn't do that impersonation, Steiger tersely replied, "Then you don't do me," and abruptly ended the conversation.
Wow.
Yeah. But basically, this is the gist of the book, and for showbiz memoir enthusiasts, they will certainly be satisfied with the wealth of stories Biner provides. It shows that this New Yorker built himself an impressive career in entertainment based on incredible talent and a good deal of luck, and he enjoyed every minute of it. So if you've enjoyed watching John Biner since the Ed Sullivan Show or the John Biner Comedy Hour like me, or Bizarre, get ready as he once again takes the stage with 5 minutes, Mr. Biner. You'll be glad you did.
You know, we mentioned earlier our connection to Just for Laughs, and John Biner came to town. He brought one of his television shows to town during the time of Just for Laughs to tap into some of the comics that were performing here in Montreal. And, of course, you know, our good friend David John McCarthy, the late David John McCarthy, mm-hmm. who I used to do a comedy radio show with for years back in the day. Good friend of mine, good friend of ours, who unfortunately left us too soon. He appeared on, I believe it was the Comedy on the Road show he was doing at the time.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct.
He appeared on John Biner's Comedy on the Road, which was shot here in Montreal. And as you always mentioned, as you mentioned earlier, John Biner used to do a lot of impersonations. And he when he introduced David John McCarthy, he introduced him as Walter Brennan. He introduced him doing the impersonation of Walter Brennan, which was rather funny. And David also killed on that show and was part of his career taking off as well. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but that was a moment. And I was in the audience for that performance because there was no way David was going to go to stardom and I wasn't going to be there to cheer him on.
So, exactly.
That was a wonderful night.
And I wonder if Biner did that Walter Brennan impression with or without teeth. That's what I'm curious about.
Hell, he did it with teeth, by the way.
And I
have that impression on tape.
Oh, great. That's what you call multi-talented.
Absolutely. So the book is?
Yeah. Called 5 Minutes, Mr. Biner by John Biner. Obviously, and it's published by Right Life Publishing, and it's $20.95.
And I know, again, with our connection to comedy and the comedy world, there must be a myriad of things you could recommend in that genre. I'm almost afraid to where you would even begin.
That's true, but that's very possible. But I want to thank an article that I stumbled upon a few short weeks ago on the New York Times website. It was written by Jason Zineman. And basically, he said, if you want to start reading comedian memoirs, he recommends 9 comedian memoirs that he deems are the essentials.
Okay.
And I want to share that with you.
Okay.
So these are the 9 that these are the essentials that you must start reading if you want to get into comedian memoirs. First, there is Harpo Speaks by Harpo Marx, obviously. Border Crime by Trevor Noah. Treadmill to Oblivion by Fred Allen. I Feel Bad About My Neck by Nora Ephron. Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. Enter Talking by Joan Rivers. How to Talk Dirty and Influence People by Lenny Bruce. Prior Convictions by Richard Pryor. And Born Standing Up by Steve Martin.
Excellent. Excellent choices.
Oh, yeah. And to hit to Zingerman, those are the essentials that you got to start with.
Excellent. And in those lists, do you, in that list, rather, well,
yeah.
I was going to ask a question, but I think I already know the answer because you're such a Marx Brothers fan. But on that list, what's your favorite?
Well, I have to go with Harpo Speaks, obviously.
Yeah.
And Lenny Bruce's book, a very close second. But I've read six of the books, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them that I haven't read, Fred Allen's Treadmill to Oblivion, which is his memoir of his days in radio. I purchased a copy back in the summer, and I'm going to start reading it very soon.
Excellent. My favorite on that list is Bossy Pants, Tina Fey.
Yeah, I agree.
That's a great one. Anyway, so this week's book, sir, is?
Is 5 Minutes, Mr. Biner by John Biner. It's published by Right Life Publishing, and it's $20.95.
And in all seriousness, no laugh involved, how does one reach out to you?
Well, not on the road, but in the pages of the Montreal Times, published every Saturday. Or if you want to go online, it's www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
And thank you from the Aardvark.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I do have a few more Stuff File news stories to get to before we get to our idiot of the day. A Florida man is accused of jumping on a neighbor's trampoline while naked and later breaking into her home while still unclothed. 21-year-old Adrian Lee Gonzalez Bradway was arrested and charged with burglary and criminal mischief. According to the sheriff's office, Gonzalez Bradway showed up naked at his neighbor's home in Lehigh Acres in the afternoon and began tapping on her door. The resident asked Gonzalez Bradway if he needed assistance, but he did not respond. 30 minutes later, the woman said she saw Gonzalez Bradway jumping on her family's trampoline while still naked. When the woman saw Gonzalez Bradway touching himself, she called 911. According to the sheriff's office, Gonzalez Bradway ran up to the woman's door demanding entry. When the woman refused, Gonzalez Bradway allegedly smashed her kitchen window. The woman then gathered her two children, a niece and a nephew, and locked herself in her vehicle while calling authorities. Lee County deputies arrived and took Gonzalez Bradway into custody. Naked trampolining. That gets things a-floppin'. I shouldn't say that out loud. It might give someone out there a slow-motion TikTok idea. On February 24th, a routine Sudanese Tarko airline flight from Khartoum to Doha, Qatar, was forced to turn around about a half hour after takeoff when a stowaway cat caused a mid-air emergency. The cat gained entry to the cockpit and became aggressive, attacking the crew, who were unable to restrain it, prompting the pilot to return to the airport. Officials believe the cat got onto the plane while it was parked overnight in a hangar in Khartoum. Now, regular listeners to the show already know what I'm going to say. Cats are evil. Little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. None of you will pay attention to this until it's too late. At the very least, can't we just put cats on the no-fly list? Let's start there. I'm not pussyfooting around. This could have been a catastrophe. Anyway, boys and girls, it's the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
Lake City, Florida police received a peculiar burglary call. Shortly before 7 p.m., officers were informed that a man had broken into a home when he decided to watch some television. When the homeowners returned, they found 34-year-old Jay Knight lying on their couch while watching their TV. You know, I bet he even had his shoes on the couch. Ugh. Knight had even put on clothing he had found inside the home. Police arrived and found him attempting to leave the area. He was detained and admitted he kicked in the door. Knight took several items from the residence and put them in a bag that he placed by the door before he began watching TV. Knight is charged with burglary, petty theft, and criminal mischief. One has to ask, was there something so compelling on television that he needed to see it? Or was this one of those extremely large-screen, high-def bells-and-whistles sets that cost the same as a small car? Because why would you break into someone's house to steal their stuff, only to plop down on the sofa to watch TV? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0603. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0603. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, and CKHR in Hay River. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Well, you weren't literally with him. Well, maybe you were, but I don't see how. I mean, he does record these in advance, you know, and okay, maybe you did listen with him. Who am I to call you a liar? And personally, I've never met the guy, and I'm not in a hurry to either.